मनोबुद्ध्यहंकार चेतानि नाहं न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमिन तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातु न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव मुक्तेर्न मेय चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा। शिवो हम शिवो शिवो हम शिवो शिवो हम शिवो
Namaste, greetings, salutations, love on this afternoon in California, which is evening in some parts of the North and South American continents, and morning, or early, very early morning in some parts of Europe. And before we get started, I just want to make a couple of housekeeping details. And one thing I want to say to those of you who are tuning into this class tomorrow or the next day, I want to suggest that you make sure that you're sitting down, because this is mostly a practice class. And some of these practices are very hard to do if you're driving, maybe easier if you're walking, but you're going to want to spend probably most of your time not only listening, but also in a seated posture where you can practice. That's one. Two is that we have a Q&A on Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific time, and Deb will send you a reminder about it. This is our final Q&A of the class, so I think we can say this is not our last class. The Q&A is our last class. And also, there have been a couple of requests or posts saying that you'd like to do class 3 of the Yoga Sutras, which would be a class on Vibhutipada, which is I would say really the heart of the text, although this text has so many hearts. We've been through several of them. The book 3, the English name of that chapter is Supernatural Powers. So it's the chapter on siddhis, but it starts with the interior practice, with dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, with concentration, the practice that is usually translated as meditation, and the practice of full absorption, and then goes on to describe how these interior practices can be applied to pretty much any area of life in order to unfold the quite extraordinary powers that are contained within our human system that we need to do some yogic cultivation to bring forth. So my plan is to begin that class probably in November, because I'm also doing another teleclass, this one on the path of living and dying, which will start in early September. I think it starts on September 8th. It's a six-week course, and I'm doing it through the Kripalu platform. So that's going to be up on our website later this week, and you'll also be able to register for it. In fact, you'll have to register for it through Kripalu. Again, welcome. And as I said earlier, this is a class very focused on internal practice. We're going to be talking about asana, pranayama, and pratyahara, and doing them. This is really, in a certain sense, it's a return to where we started in our class on book 1, the chapter on samadhi, where we did a lot of practice with inner meditation modalities. And in this one, well, they're not technically on meditation, but one of the things that we come to recognize with the Patanjali Yoga Sutras is that pretty much any practice, any one of these interior practices, is actually meditation. So that is what it's going to be today. A lot of you have said that this class has given you a new appreciation for the Yoga Sutra, and this has certainly been true for me. I've studied this text and taught it for a long time, and always with an appreciation of the particularity with which it outlines the stages and steps of yoga, but this class has felt to me like literally a stream of transmission coming through several lineages, the lineages of this that are behind this text, but also others. And part of what it's shown me is the absolute universality of these teachings. But I do actually think that a lot of the power of this class comes from the fact that so many of us are finding our personal way during an extremely challenging collective period. And for many of you, the lockdown that we experienced earlier this spring and that many of us are experiencing to some degree now, I certainly am, I'm not out and about that much, it's given us space for practice and especially a space for contemplation. And even if you're among those who's been super busy during this time, you know, I would say that the contemplation that it's engendered and the realization of what yoga is for has become stronger and stronger over the course of this time together. You know, yoga may not always solve the external issues that we face as human beings, but it does much more than offer respite, and respite it certainly offers. So it has something to do with the fact that yoga inspires us to see our lives from the widest possible perspective and to see our lives as a journey that, despite what we may have believed, we are fully equipped for, because we have these powers within us, we have these capacities within us, and we have, in the form of this particular text and its map, we actually have a path. You know, as Vicky wrote in a post on Monday, all adventures are the same adventure. All paths call us back to the heart. And really what we've been able to do that I'm enormously grateful for is create together a laboratory where we can experiment with what it means to integrate practice with life. You know, this class, especially certain of them, the last couple of classes certainly, have called us on our self-sabotaging habits, on our illusions, on our resistance to growth, and it's brought out that longing for awakening that, you know, we may normally have buried underneath the demands of life, but which has truly accompanied every one of you, and certainly me, through all the different paths that we've followed over the years, the apparently spiritual and the apparently worldly, and of course, through the realization that there really is no separation between the so-called spiritual and the so-called worldly. So let's find ourselves a posture, and we're going to go back and forth into some of the intricacies of asana. But right now, let's find a strong practice, a strong asana practice, a strong seat. Make sure that you're sitting, if you're on a cushion, that your butt, your hips, are 2 to 4 inches above your knees, that you're lifted through the hips. This is going to become important later on. Feel the scapular muscles clasping the back, the wings of the shoulder blades clasping the back. And see if you can position yourself so that the crown is directly over the perineum, so that you're actually sitting in that midpoint where the sitz bones are fully in contact with the seat, but you're not leaning too far forward or too far back, that your torso is positioned in such a way that you actually could stretch a string from your crown up towards the ceiling and then take that same string down through the center of your body, through the perineum and right into the seat. Inhale and feel the sitz bones and hips and buttocks relaxing, releasing. Exhale and feel the torso rising upward through the crown. Find yourself now on the shores of the lake. Just be aware of the atmosphere, the beauty of the lake. The softness of the breeze, the bottomless deep blue waters, and the presence of all of us seated in a circle around it. All of us who are here, other beings, yogis, guides, masters, the beings who guard this space, this lake, who make their grace available to us, and also anyone whom you would like to invite. We're all sitting. And as we allow ourselves to settle into this place, to recognize that we're in a space where awareness is invited to become pristine, where reality can be experienced at its subtlest level, and where the love that is the essence of this cosmos comes off the lake like mist and embraces us. So with this sense of being held in sacred presence, let your attention come into the heart. Feeling that as the breath flows in, the inhalation touches the heart. Space around the heart gently expands. You become aware perhaps of the presence of the flame of the self in the deep heart. And then taking your candle in your hands, feel that with your siddhi, with your fire-lighting siddhi, you allow a flame to come out of the tips of your fingers of your right hand. You ignite the wick. And then with great reverence, you place within the flame your intention for the evening. And our intention, may all beings be free of suffering. May all beings know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. May all beings experience equanimity without grasping hatred or dullness. May we know the equality of all that lives. And now place the candle on the lake. And imagine that you take your ordinary mind, your karmic mind, and place that in the lake as well. And with that awareness that we've brought our mind into the lake of consciousness, we'll chant, starting with three ohms and then our three invocations. Om. Shivaya Gurave Satchitananda Murataye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase Sarva Mangala Mangalye Shive Sarvatra Sadike Sharanye Trayambake Gauri Narayani Namostute. Vande Gurunam Charanaravinde Sandarshita Swatmasukava Bodhe Nishreyase Jangalikayamane Samsara Hala Halamoha Shantyai Habahu Purushakaram Shankachakra Siddharinam Sahasrashirasam Shvetam Pranamami Patanjalim Pranamami Patanjalim Pranamami Patanjalim. Now bring your attention to the space at the opening of the nostrils, the threshold of the nostrils. And as you inhale and exhale, become aware with the exhalation of how the breath flows out through the nostrils and dissolves somewhere in front of your face, in a space about 10 inches in front of your body. And become aware, because we're going to talk about this quite a bit, as you inhale and exhale for this moment, letting the inhalation touch the threshold of the nostrils. The exhalation flow outward into space and see if you can find the place where it dissolves, recognizing that this outer limit, this place where the exhalation dissolves, is actually the outer limit of your subtle body, your pranic body, of what in some people call your auric field. So, in other words, what the prana is showing us in this moment when we follow the exhalation to its culminating point is that our bodies are not just bounded by the skin, but they actually flow outwards into our personal space of consciousness. And on the edges of this space, our personal energy meets the energy of the air, the energy of the room, the energy of the other people in our presence. But we ourselves are held inside this space of our own awareness that is always being energized by the prana, and which we're going to energize even more fully as we practice today. So now inhale, see if you can inhale. Don't make too much of an effort, but just see if it actually is intuitively possible to inhale with the feeling that the breath is flowing in from this place close to the end of the exhalation. Feel it flowing in through your nostrils and rising from the nostrils up through the corners of the eyes, up through the space inside the head parallel to the center between the eyebrows, up to the space in the very center of the head behind the forehead, rising as far as it wants to rise, and then flowing down through the space behind the forehead, the space behind the eyebrows, the inner corners of the eyes, the nostrils, and then out the nostrils to dissolve into the space in front of you. And just let yourself find the rhythm of this breath, the breath flowing in the nostrils, flowing upward, touching the corners of the eyes, up through the space between the eyebrows, the center of the forehead, rising beyond if that's natural. And then allowing the exhalation to draw your attention downward from the center of the head to the center behind the eyebrows, to the corner of the eyes, to the threshold of the nostrils. You're simply following the easeful flow of the prana shakti, flowing in and upward, flowing down and merging into the space outside. You're following the flow of the breath upward, allowing the exhalation to bring your attention, your awareness down, flowing through the nostrils. The breath is easeful. And your attention is not forced. In these moments, as we begin to interiorize our consciousness together, let the breath be the power that draws your attention into the body. And as you become used to this particular flow, allow it to become as effortless as possible. And you're very welcome to stay in this flow. We're going to be coming back to this practice and doing some variations on it, because this particular practice is both a pranayama, a practice of breath refinement. It's also a process of pratyahara, sense withdrawal, and it very naturally segues into dhyana, into concentration and meditation. So it's one of those practices that we come across in the Yoga Sutra that we can actually follow straight into samadhi, and which is also going to very definitely shift our relationship to our own breath and to our own prana. And I have to say that as I was preparing this class and playing with some of the pranayama practices that we're going to be working with here, trying to make a choice between all the kind of amazing pranayama practices that we could be working on and getting more and more into the zone which pranayama can send us into. I suddenly began thinking of something my guru used to say, which was always very mysterious to me. It's a quote from a text. I'm not sure what text it is. I think it's one of the Upanishads. It says, worship the Lord of Prana. Worship the Lord of Prana. And what that means, as far as I have been able to intuitively discern, what that means is that the source from which prana arises and subsides is the source of the entire universe, and, you know, is that being, that presence that the Yoga Sutra calls Ishvara. And part of what makes the Yoga Sutras so gorgeous and so profoundly and endlessly relevant is that it actually can be applied. It works in any situation where human beings are striving to unite their individual self with that source, with, you know, that presence, that essence, which in this context could be called the Lord of Prana or the Atman. So whoever it is that is the source of this tradition was speaking from the very center of yogic wisdom, which I define as the place where celestial wisdom, celestial awareness meets human need. We don't really know whether Patanjali was an actual living person, a human being who took birth in the world, or whether Patanjali was the name that the tradition gives to a series of channeled teachings. I kind of think it was the latter. But Patanjali in mythology, as you know from the invocation, is associated with the primordial earth serpent Ananta, whose name means endless, or sometimes it's translated as eternal, and who is supposed to hold the earth on his head. We come across Ananta in paintings of the Buddha, you know, with its hood outstretched to form a protective canopy over the Buddha's head. You see him in paintings of other sages, and of course in one of the most famous iconographic images of Vishnu, the blue deity Vishnu is shown sleeping in the coils of a great serpent floating on the ocean of consciousness with the goddess Lakshmi sitting at his feet, being a very beautiful and traditional wife and massaging his feet while he sleeps. But another way of understanding Ananta is to recognize that he's not a he at all, but an iconographic representation of Shakti Kundalini, the life force herself, the creative cosmic power of the Absolute, who, of course, is often depicted as a coiled serpent resting in the root chakra. So Kundalini is, in the most cosmic understanding of Kundalini, which is the understanding of the tantras and also of hardcore hatha yogis of the esoteric Knot tradition, which Natha, not Knot, is really the sect or the school from which modern postural yoga, hatha yoga, derives. So Kundalini is seen in these traditions not simply as a biological energy, though she certainly is that, but as a cosmic prana, which arises from within the heart of Shakti at the most primordial level. So because Shakti's nature is to create, her essence is to create, what that means is that the essence of everything is creativity. So we could say that the universe, or Kundalini taking the form of this universe, is always emerging in ever new displays of novelty. And because we humans are limited but still complete versions of Shakti, our creativity also mirrors that cosmic creativity. And of course, one of the ways that it, the cosmic and human creativity manifests through the ages is as the expansion, the fresh expansion of new approaches to these teachings, which are always being renewed for every era. So what I'm coming back to here is that the wisdom in these sutras is actually the gift of Kundalini, which is one of the ways that we interpret the first sutra, now, which, you know, Atta Yoga, now yoga begins. You know, that first sutra is often translated or interpreted as meaning, let's come back to the present moment, to the ever-new experience of the present moment, which is where yoga begins. But it also, in the esoteric tradition, refers to a particular geometric representation inside the human cranium, which can be seen in meditation. Some of you have seen it, which is known as the Akata triangle, a triangle that exists in the center of the mandala, known as the Sri Chakra, and in the center of our own cranium, and which is the meeting point from which that, or into which, the teachings of the Absolute pour, constantly pouring through us, creating our body-mind over and over again. And to say that this path, that yoga itself comes from that particular place, is to say that it comes from the meeting of the Absolute consciousness with the individual consciousness. And the thing that I always see when I study this, and maybe you have too, is that these sutras are consciously non-religious, even though they refer to a being whom they call Ishwara. They also make it very clear that by Ishwara they do not mean a sectarian deity, because Ishwara, remember, is pure awareness and love. Ishwara is the innate guru, the inner teacher, the guide, the intuition, the prajna, your own highest awareness. And we can, of course, call Ishwara God or Goddess, and many of us are naturally drawn to doing that. I certainly am, but you don't have to. And that's why this teaching works just as well for secular meditators, for Christian meditators, for Jewish meditators, as it does for Hindu or Buddhist or Taoist meditators. Because the principles here, you know, that the purpose of yoga and the purpose of life is to find the still point where thought dissolves into consciousness and where the sacred nature of our being is revealed, that our own intelligence, our buddhi, can be purified such that it will naturally reveal the truth about the inner and outer world, and that we can follow this process which the text lays out, and it will lead us from our ordinary distracted and suffering state to the point where we actually can step beyond suffering. These principles, you know, as you know, if you've studied other traditions, these principles are reflected in Vedanta, in Tantra, in Taoism. Certainly there are versions of it in the Buddhist teachings. And, you know, in Book 2, we followed this skillful map as it took us step by step through the kleshas, the means of dissolving them, and now into the 8 stages of interiorization, the 8 limbs. And again, you know, several of you have mentioned that you've seen the patterns that connect the yamas and the niyamas with each other, that they all support each other, that they all actually necessitate each other. And in fact, this is true of all the 8 limbs. In other words, we can't really practice pranayama, pratyahara, certainly not asana, certainly not concentration, meditation, and samadhi, without taking the help of the 8 limbs, especially the last 3 niyamas, which are at the heart of Kriya Yoga, the intense effort called tapas, the self-study practice called Swadhyaya, and of course, surrender. We are studying these practices step by step, but realizing that they're a wholeness as they naturally segue into each other, and that as we put the different parts together, we begin to realize that that our practice naturally will take us through them, will open up each phase of them to us, and yet that when we start to break down the individual aspects of the path, it gives so much more richness to the practice. Just bringing back a shout out to Tapas Swadhyaya and Ishwara Pranidhan, I just want to quote Pandit Rajmani, who says, these three, Tapas Swadhyaya and Ishwara Pranidhan, go hand in hand and together breathe life into all the other limbs of yoga. Without these three, the yamas and niyamas remain confined to the realm of ethics and morality. Asana remains a set of exercises for enhancing physical health. Pranayama will improve our vitality, strength, and stamina, nothing more. Pratyahara is merely an excellent tool for relaxing our nervous system. And although dharana, dhyana, and samadhi will enhance our mental concentration, they will have little or no spiritual value without effort, study of the self, and surrender. So we enter into the foundational practices for the inner yoga, asana, pranayama, and pratyahara, informed by our practice of tapas, of study, and of surrender, which have both prepared us for the inner practice and also will continue to enhance it as we go. So, asana. Asana is the beginning and in some ways the end. And the sutra is one of the sutra on asana. The main sutra on asana is very famous. It's sutra 46. Stira sukham asanam. Stira sukham asanam. If you've done yoga practice in one of the traditional hatha yoga sampradayas, you probably know this sutra well. A stable and comfortable posture is asana, which is saying that no posture is a yogic posture unless it is both stable and comfortable. So the basic principle behind asana is the understanding that our body is the universe, and that everything that exists in the outer world, including the sun, the moon, and the various sacred places, power spots of the earth, can also be found in the body. And more than that, that it contains divine powers. These divine powers, as you know if you've studied the chakras, they are very much part of the subtle system of the chakras. But they're also in the physical body, which is why opening the body through asana is such a powerful practice, as many of you know, because it gives us access to the natural abilities, which, and these are very specific abilities, including strength, vitality, vigor, beauty, which means much more than the development of a great yoga butt, the ability to heal ourselves and others, and this very interesting capacity, which in Sanskrit is called lavana, which literally means saltiness. And lavanya means the capacity to live a life full of taste, of flavor, of juiciness, you know, just as salt gives flavor to foods. This quality in the body gives flavor to life. So that, in other words, without developing the body, without developing a stable, comfortable posture, our lives are tasteless, and that is juiceless, flavorless. So asana practice is a practice for developing very profound yogic powers. And these include the ability to heal ourselves and others. So, of course, as with all our other natural powers, these qualities, vigor, beauty, capacity to bring flavor into every situation of our life, and this healing power get diminished by the kleshas and the karmas. And really the promise of yoga is basically that it's going to restore our natural powers along with taking us beyond our ordinary human self into our divine self. It's also going to restore the human powers that many of us have let go of as a result of falling victim to the kleshas. Those of you who do a full hatha yoga practice, and by full I mean everything from a half hour to 45 minute practice to, you know, the full 2 hours that you do in a yoga class, know how much transformation occurs in the body through targeted and well-sequenced postures. But, and that said, it's often mentioned that even though the Yoga Sutras are considered to be the core text of modern postural yoga, out of the nearly 200 sutras, there are only 3 on asana. And in his commentary, Vyasa describes only a few postures, which notably are essentially seated postures. In other words, postures that lead directly into meditation. Sitting in a yogic asana, a meditative asana, is itself a major tapas. It's actually one of the great tapasic practices. I don't know if tapasic is a real word, but it is one of the great tapases that we do. And I, you know, anyone who's really decided to train yourself to sit in half lotus or full lotus, to sit in virasana, which is the kneeling posture that's used a lot in Zen, or to sit in siddhasana, where you pull your heels together, press them against the perineum. You know, these are the 3 main sitting postures. They're hard. You know, when I teach in yoga studios where the students are often people who have a very strong hatha yoga practice, most of them have a hard time sitting still. And so the first question that I often hear from yoga students is, what should I do about my knees? And my lower back hurts. So practice of asana often means sitting through discomfort and learning how to find a posture that is actually comfortable. I learned to sit in half lotus. I became pretty good at Padmasana, but I never became comfortable in it. And I want to say that some of us, I'm not one of them, but some people have legs that are meant for sitting in Padmasana. And that, in generally speaking, that means they have skinny legs. People with fuller thighs and calves don't get into that posture so easily, though of course you can, which is why half lotus is, generally speaking, the posture of choice. How I did it was I would start with 15 minutes, then I would move, and then I would add 1 minute a day to my sit time until I got to the point where I could sit for 45 minutes comfortably. And as time went on, I learned how to sit for an hour. That meant sitting through a lot of knee pain and back pain. And again, I know many of you have gone through this process and you know what I'm talking about. You reach a point which is one of the boons, one of the siddhis of asana practice. You reach a point where you actually can forget about your body, the discomfort of your body dissolves, and you become, as Sutta 48 says, able to withstand the pairs of opposites, meaning discomfort, strain, heat, and cold. This actually happens fairly soon after you start a serious asana practice. That said, I was in my 20s when I did this kind of practice. I did it from about age 27 to about age 55. I was extremely flexible. And that said, sitting that way, which I actually did for hours every day because I was, for much of that time, I was living in an ashram and doing everything on the floor, that eventually blew out my knees. So I now meditate sitting in a chair in what's called the Maitri asana, which Maitri means friendly. So it's the asana that's friendly to everybody. So, and it's fine because a lot of my meditation breakthroughs, and I know yours, especially those of you who are older, have come about through sitting on a chair as long as you can keep your back straight and stay steady. But that said, there's absolutely no question that if you can sit for a while in a really steady and comfortable yogic asana, the half lotus, virasana, siddhasana, if you can sit for a while in these postures, you will fall into meditation almost automatically because these yogic sitting postures create a subtle balance in the flow of prana through the nadis, the pranic channels that interweave through the body. And this has an effect on the senses, which naturally start to turn inward. So as I said, at a certain point, you're no longer feeling the physical body unless you choose to. And that's the point at which your sense of the physical starts to dissolve and you actually move into the subtle body, into the body of prana that interpenetrates the physical body. So in Zen, for instance, which is a tradition which places a lot of emphasis on posture, you're expected to sit without moving in sessions without moving for 45 minutes to an hour. And if you move or shake or slump, the meditation director, at least in traditional Zen circles, will hit you with a stick, which is a special stick that's with a flat, a flat side of it. And the stick is not, it's not meant to be a punishment, but a wake-up call. It's, it's just, it's meant to remind you to sit up. And a lot of the work of meditation gets done in that way. In fact, in Zen, again, this is not news to many of you, there's a very advanced stage of practice that's called Shikantaza, which means just sitting. That's all you do. You sit. You feel yourself in the posture. You might start off following the breath, but basically the idea is to let everything go and just be there. That said, Zen practitioners, like many others of different traditions, learned from the Hatha Yoga world that if you actually do a range of postures, standing, sitting, twisting, inversions, they will not only strengthen your body and make it more flexible, but the other asanas also change the flow of prana so it becomes possible to sit longer in comfort. So if you want to do this, this kind of practice, I really recommend that you also do some other asanas. But it's the stability and comfort and ability to find ease in the body that makes a posture yogic, which is why sitting on a chair is okay. If it requires a lot of effort, if it's too hard, if it makes you uncomfortable, if your knees hurt, that will eventually cause injury. But also, if you're uncomfortable, the shift in the flow of prana doesn't happen. And then yoga is just exercise. So the essence of posture is first that it be done correctly with proper alignment and precision given, the nature of your own physical body. It'll look different. And second, that once you've found your best version of the posture, you need to be able to soften in it to release tension. And finally, you actually need to be able to stay there for a while, to stay at the threshold, the very edge of discomfort, but not to go over into discomfort. You take yourself to the edge, you stay there as long as you don't become uncomfortable, you soften, and this, as Hatha yogis know, is really only possible if you're tuned into the breath. So asana inevitably involves pranayama. So wherever you are, you can stand and do this, but you can also do it very effectively in a sitting posture. So grab your knees and bend forward from the hips over the knees as far forward as is comfortable and see if you can feel the connection between the root, the base of the coccyx, and the crown so that you're not bending your upper back, you're actually feeling the stretch. And what I would like you to do is notice where you feel the stretch. Noticing the space in the lower back, maybe the abdominal cavity. And just stay there for a few more seconds. And then gently breathe. Inhale and exhale, focusing in the lower back. So you're actually breathing into the place where the stretch is happening. And then breathe yourself back up to an upright posture. And one of the principles of asana is that since every posture awakens and brings consciousness to the particular part of the body, the real gift of finding comfort in a posture is to find the space which the posture naturally targets. So this is actually the purpose of asana, not just getting good at the posture, but being able to become absorbed in the inner space in the body which the posture awakens or targets. So if you're doing a standing pose like Warrior One, your attention will come to the core of the belly and, of course, to the thighs. If you're doing a forward bend, you'll become aware of the lower back and also the pelvic and abdominal cavities, especially if you're standing. A back bend will make you aware of the scapular muscles, the inner chest, and, of course, it also involves the legs, especially if you press your feet down and, you know, let the energy flow from your feet up through the chest. So, and the longer you can stay comfortably in the pose, the more the subtle intelligence of these areas of the body comes online. And this is, you know, again, those of you who do strong asana know this, that this is part of what an asana will do. It'll open up this kind of expansiveness in these areas of the body. So find yourself a yogic posture, and I mean a sitting posture. If you can do half lotus, that's great, but you can also sit in the easy pose. And if you are sitting on a chair, that's fine. Just make sure that your feet are flat on the floor. If you can do 5 minutes in, you know, in a floor seated asana without strain or discomfort, this is really important, then this would be a good moment to do it. And make sure if you're on the floor that your hips are elevated 2 to 4 inches above the knees. So you'll want to sit on a cushion or some blankets. So I'm giving you a moment to find your posture. Remember that the back is straight, the crown rises towards the ceiling, the chin is slightly tucked. So I'm going to give you step-by-step instructions for getting into the posture, and we're going to do this as a meditation. So the crown is in line with the perineum. The shoulder blades release onto the back, and the scapular muscles actually engage to help lift the torso. The chin is slightly tucked so that there is a little curve in the neck, but it's not too far forward and not too far back. And in the same way, your torso is lined up with your crown such that you're also not leaning too far forward or leaning too far back. So we're going to begin with abdominal breathing, using the diaphragm, the wide muscle that connects the two sides of the rib cage, to draw the breath in. And as you do, the abdomen will naturally expand. If you like, you can put your fingers over the area of the sternum, the upper abdomen, your hands, your palms down, over the sternum, the upper abdomen, with the tips of the middle finger just slightly touching. And as you inhale, using the diaphragm, the abdomen will naturally puff out a little bit, and this will bring your hands apart just a fraction of an inch. And then when you exhale, the abdomen comes back towards the spine, and the tips of the middle fingers come back together. So you're just using your hands to bring your attention to the diaphragmatic part of the inhalation and exhalation. And the breath is brought in with attention to the diaphragm, but gently begins to rise up to the chest so that it, you actually do feel it filling the lungs. Inhaling with this diaphragmatic breath, let the breath come down to the sits bones and ground. And then with the exhalation, feel the breath rising up through the spinal column, literally vertebra by vertebra, flowing upward, growing the spine up through the crown. And just do this grounding breath a couple of times. And notice, are you comfortable? Do you need to make some adjustments in your posture? Is there a part of your body that's holding tension, maybe your shoulders or your jaw or the belly? Can you soften? So just take a moment to run your attention through the body, noticing where there's tension, where there's tightness, and softening. Softening the belly. Softening the lower back. Softening the thighs. Finding that sweet spot where the body is aligned, but not with tension, where the back is straight, but not rigid. Now with the next inhalation, feel your attention and the energy in your body moving inward so that you begin to feel space inside the body. And in a seated posture, your attention should be in the area within the torso, the chest and the belly. For some of you, your attention might tend to rest in the heart. For others, in the lower belly. Some of you may find that it rises to the head, which is fine, but for now, we want to keep our awareness inside the torso, the general area of the torso. And as you enter the space of the torso, letting the breath flowing naturally, feel that the entire body is filled with space. If you're visual, you might imagine it as a sky or simply as a kind of luminosity, a sense of presence, of a luminous presence. It fills the entire region of the torso from the perineum up through the crown, so it also includes the head. So as you sit in the posture, feel as though the breath flows like wind through the inner space of the body. And though, of course, the physical body is filled with organs, understand that the organs arise out of the inner space, which is the true subtlety of the body. that space pervades the organs of the body. That every atom of the body is 99% space. And that this space is utterly filled with Shakti, with Kundalini. It's in that awareness of the space within the body. And for some of you, that sense of space may be expanding through the skin barrier so that you're also aware of that space, not only permeating the body, but surrounding it. It is awareness of the interior space of the body that actually allows the healing siddhi, the healing power of the body, to come online in asana. And if there's a part of the body that feels uncomfortable or tight or injured in any way, see if you can bring the sense of space into that joint, because it is often the joints. And if there need to be adjustments in the posture, let the adjustments happen naturally as the breath blows through the inner body like the wind blowing through the sky. How are you experiencing that space? Does it have a kinesthetic feeling to it? Is there a luminosity? Is there a sense of peace associated with it? Can you perhaps feel spaciousness in some parts of the body but not in the whole body? Just let the breath expand your sense of space. Inhaling, feel the luminosity of the space in the body. Exhaling, feel it permeating and expanding from within to the area around your body. Sutra 47 points to this dual focus as the real essence of yogic asana. What makes a seated posture asana, assuming you're in reasonable alignment, is this: relaxation of effort and meditation on the infinite. In other words, sitting in a yogic posture, letting go of tension and meditating on the spaciousness, which is in this posture, in this situation, is the doorway to the infinite. You are in meditation. Now, in Vyasa's commentary on Sutra 47, he also says that softening the body, relaxing, is actually the cure for instability. Because what makes our posture feel uncomfortable and unstable is the tension that we put into it. So the trick in asana is to align and then soften, and then align and then soften. And as you soften and relax, there might be some slumping or some movement. So you align again, and then you relax. What I find really interesting about this sutra is, first of all, this understanding that if you sit in asana and meditate on the space inside the body, it actually does in time open the body to the infinitude within it. And of course, this is what happens in advanced Zen practice, in the Shikantaza practice. What we come to learn through asana meditation is our own spaciousness, which, by the way, is called ananta, bringing us back to what we said in the beginning, the endless or the infinite. And as you feel into the space, you might begin to notice its vibrating, pulsating quality. And here's what's really interesting, that vibrating, pulsating Shakti quality of the inner body can be experienced as tension or discomfort. But as we tune into tension or discomfort or over-relaxing, slumping, or under-relaxing, tightening, do you notice that these little micro-releases start to happen? And they happen spontaneously. You don't make them happen. The intelligence of the body begins to release as you sit in alignment with the intention to relax and the feeling of space. Asana, in other words, is not simply a practice of the gross level of the body. First of all, it's always combined with attention to the breath, which means attention to the prana shakti, the life force, and attention to the inner space. So the breath and the space are the subtle aspects of the physical body, and when we do asana, when we do especially seated asana, but also the other asanas, we will start to experience kundalini as currents of energy that flow through the body that we can begin to notice, become aware of, and which the more we notice them, the more we notice the way energy flows inside the body. The more we begin to experience the natural empowerment that comes with active kundalini. So you know that kundalini is not only the power behind the breath, which it is, it's the power that makes the breath flow in and out. It's also the space that holds the breath. And it is the source of the siddhis, the powers that are held in different parts of the physical body. So, you know, every center in the physical body connects to a subtle center and has its own intelligence, which you find by becoming present to that part of the body and just allowing it to reveal what's there. You know, when you meditate on the hara, on the lower abdomen, you discover that there's a particular state that arises there. You know, I feel it as grounded, as peaceful, as very thought-free, as kind of solid. Meditating on the hara will give a lot of vigor to the physical body. So the navel region has its own particular wisdom, which is very sharp and pointed and active. You know, the heart has its own qualities, which are manifold, not only relational, but really opening up to all kinds of different forms of intuitive understanding. The chakras in the head open us to many different levels of transcendental wisdom and also open the subtle senses, which are what allow us to experience powers like inner sight or clairaudience, and also the power to really experience the subtle senses. So, you know, when you get this entrance into the self-healing qualities of the body, So it's there you are in your posture, feeling the posture in the space. And we're going to flow into pranayama. Sutra 49 says, complete mastery over the roaming tendencies of inhalation and exhalation is pranayama. It's to be practiced only after mastering asana. Now, pranayama practice is one of the most powerful practices we can do in yoga. And when they say that pranayama is powerful, they're really not kidding, because pranayama can completely change the relationship of your body to your subtle, of your physical body to your subtle body, can change the way your intelligence works, can change the way your brain works. And learning how to come to your own right relationship with the breath is, of course, critical. I've just read a book, which I would like to recommend, called Breath. It just came out quite recently. It's by a guy named James Nestor, and I'll include it in the homework. And it describes his own research and experience with transforming his own breathing, why it is so important, especially why diaphragmatic breathing is so important. And part of what he comes to is a group of pranayama practices that are straight out of the yoga texts. So pranayama is often necessary for us for completely health-related reasons, because many of us, of course, don't know how to breathe. It's, you know, maybe there's fear in the breath, or maybe we have asthma or another issue with the lungs, or often with the nasal passages, which turn out to have an enormous effect on how we breathe. I only began to do serious pranayama in the last couple of years because I was trained in a tradition which was very grace-based. So we didn't do a lot of practices that relied on yogic precision. My guru believed that it wasn't necessary if you had an awakened kundalini. And one reason for that is because when kundalini is active in the body, she will create spontaneous pranayama kriyas, including spontaneous bastrika, the bellows breath, or spontaneous breath retention. Sometimes, you know, some of you who practice with an awake kundalini may find that there are times when your breath stops on its own. But I actually found that because I have lung issues, I had to ease very carefully into pranayama. And this is not unusual. So it requires a willingness to be very, very mindful of your breathing, to really do it from some degree of witness awareness, and to commit yourself to the practice enough so that you're willing to move through resistance. Because just as asana has its own quality of tapas, so does pranayama. And in fact, when the yogis give their definitions of tapas, they often include pranayama practice, partly because the purpose of tapas is to remove the veilings over the light. That is, your body is actually at the subtlest level made of light, and pranayama is the basic means for doing that. I want to call your attention to two things about pranayama, and then we're going to begin to do a series of pranayama practices, which will take up much of the rest of our time here. You know, first, if you do pranayama before meditation, as we have been doing throughout this class, you find that it really enhances your meditation. In fact, once you get used to doing pranayama before meditation, you'll often find that you just go right into meditation at the end of pranayama. And second, as again many of you have noticed, most of the standard beginning meditations that we practice are breath-focused. In fact, meditation, the way it's done these days by all of us, including me and, you know, including my students, is essentially pranayama practice. You know, so standard Buddhist mindfulness is pranayama. Standard yogic mindfulness is pranayama. So we're going to start with a classic basic breath meditation, and then we're going to let it expand itself. So find your posture. I should have told you to release your posture. But in any case, find your posture again. And begin to focus on the breath as it flows into the threshold of the nostrils. Feel the breath touching the sides of the nostrils as you inhale, and then sense it moving across your upper nostrils. And exhale if you need to. But then as we inhale, feel the breath again coming in through the sides of the nostrils, moving across the upper nostrils, flowing upward from the back of the nasal cavity until it just touches the inner corners of the eyes. And see if you can feel that there's a certain feeling that's present in the center of the inner corners of the eyes. See if you can just touch it. The inhalation flows up into the forehead, into the region behind the eyebrows, up into the center of the head. Now you're in the Ajna Chakra. And continues to rise up to the natural limit of the inhalation. And then with the exhalation, it flows downward, again, moving from the inside of the head behind the forehead through the center behind the eyebrows, through the corners of the eyes, through the nostrils, and dissolving outside. Now we're going to take this just another step, and this is going to be the practice that we'll a little bit later in the class, we'll sit for a longer time with it, and it's going to be your homework practice for the week. This is how it's going to work. So you'll breathe in to the threshold of the nostrils as we did before, but then as the inhalation continues, bring your awareness to the tip of the nose, just outside the body. So you're at the tip of the nose, not inside the tip of the nose, but on the outside of the tip of the nose. And then you allow your attention to flow upward in front of your face. Your breath is flowing in front of your face to the area directly in front of the corners of your eyes, the area directly in front of the space between the eyebrows, and the area in front of the forehead. And then we'll allow the exhalation to flow downward from as high as the inhalation has gone down to the region of the tip of the nose, and then to flow outward towards the outer edge of the aura, that space about 10 inches in front of your face. So what we're doing in this practice is actually opening up the awareness that your body is not behind the skin. Your body extends 10 to 12 inches outward on all sides, and these outer spaces are the limits of your individual body, but also the subtle aspects of the body that can open up to giving you the experience of an absolute palpable energetic connection with whatever is around you. Now we'll begin the practice inhaling with the sense that the breath is coming from that place about 10 inches in front of the face to just the edge, the tip of the nose, and then moving up in front of the face to the space corresponding to the corners of the eyes, to the space just in front of the space between the eyebrows, just in front of the forehead. The breath rises as far as it comfortably can, and then begins to descend in the same pathway, slowing down to the region just in front of the tip of the nose, and then flowing outward. And see if you can really follow this pathway, feeling the kinesthetics of it, really letting yourself tune into breath awareness. So this is a practice of really kinesthetic awareness of the breath. As much as possible, you want to see if you can be aware of the breath starting at this, let's call it a zero point, about 10 inches in front of your face, and then flowing inward to the region in front of the tip of the nose, upward to this region of the corners of the eyes, and upward into the greater Ajna Chakra, rising perhaps to the area above the crown and then flowing downward. And if you eliminate the concept of the limitations or the skin barrier that separates your physical body from the air, you might begin to notice that in this particular form of breathing, the barrier starts to disappear and you become aware that the breath is moving not only in front of your face, but also behind your face, as it were, inside the body. And what you may begin to recognize is that you are in touch now with the pranic current, the pranic body. Getting in touch with the pranic body, or learning to feel the pranic body, is actually the point of pranayama. Because the breath happens to be the most direct means that we have for tuning into the subtle prana, which is actually the life force. So the breath serves as a kind of connector, or, you know, let's call it a rope that draws a much subtler prana shakti into the particular area that we are tuning to. And it is through that attention that the prana, whether it's drawn into a chakra or an organ or simply flows, as it is here, it's able to work its alchemical magic and begin to dispel the physical and mental samskaras. In a way, of course, we know this. You know, there's a very famous yogic truth, which is that mind and prana are mutually dependent. They're so connected that when one is agitated, the other is agitated, and that we can calm the mind by calming the prana and vice versa. You know, which is why when you're having an anxiety attack or a panic attack, you'll be told to focus on the breath. But here's the thing about prana. Prana is Shakti. Prana is directly Shakti. It's not, I mean, everything is Shakti, but in the special sense that the prana, the life force behind the breath, within the breath, is the active creative force in the universe. So, you know, one of the tantric, modern tantric truths is that if you want to find Shiva and Shakti, if you want to unite Shiva and Shakti, the two aspects of the absolute in the body, you do it by uniting awareness with breath. Because Shiva is held in the body as awareness. In Sankhya, we call it Purusha. Shakti is in the body in a most direct form as the breath. Prana, in other words, is spanda. It's the cosmic pulsation that arises in the heart of the absolute and condenses into the physical world. And so prana is always pulsating. It's always moving. But the trick in pranayama is to make that movement so subtle that it is simply experienced as aliveness and then becomes the engine that draws the mind into deeper and deeper states. The word pranayama is usually translated as control of breath, but it's more accurately translated as expansion or stretching of the life force. So not just the breath, but the force within it gets stretched. And the way it is stretched in classical pranayama is by restraint of breath, by holding the breath, you know, and allowing yourself to experience the prana behind the breath, which begins to come vibrantly online when we're able to hold the breath. Another meaning of pranayama, actually of the suffix ayama, ayama means taking away restrictions. In other words, what pranayama does, once you develop the practice, is that it takes away the restrictions and tensions in the breath. And one of the reasons that for instance, doing a full yogic breath or Nadi Shodhana can be difficult for some of us is because there is tension in the breath, you know, which comes from many different causes, including apparently negative experiences at birth. But in general, you know, sometimes from, as we said earlier, lung issues or nasal issues. But if we keep doing the practice at the rate that's most comfortable for us, we will eventually be able to experience the natural breath, which is literally a river of Shakti, a river of prana, which will, as it finds its own natural rhythm, it'll start to reveal to us what underlies everything in the physical body. Prana is not, you know, is both the name of the cosmic life force. It's also the name of that function in the body that brings the breath in and out. The five great pranas govern different aspects of our functioning. You know, the Udana prana operates in the head and upper chakras, and it's the aspect of prana that gets activated as Kundalini rises. It's also the prana that takes the soul out of the body at the time of death. The prana operates between the larynx and the bottom of the heart and, of course, governs respiration and speech. Samana rules the region between the heart and the navel and has to do with digestion. Apana operates below the navel, governs the kidneys, the colon, the genitals, the organs of elimination and generation. And Vyana pervades the body and governs the movements of air in the joints. So when you have gas in the body or when your joints are snappy or crackly, it's usually the result of imbalances in the Vyana prana. And our pranayama practice begins to cure any imbalances in all of these pranas. we're going to do some practice with breath retention, and we're going to do it very simple one, nothing complicated. And I'm also going, but I'm going to send you a little piece of, a little, how shall we say, cliff notes on pranayama, on the different ways we can hold the breath in pranayama. In case you want to practice different forms of classical pranayama practice, you'll have some guidelines. So in Sutra 50, Patanjali gives the classical instruction about the yogic pranayama, which includes breath retention. And the sutra goes, pranayama with breath retention can be threefold: external, internal, or stopping the breath wherever it is. So these external means that you stop the breath at the end of the exhalation. Internal means that you stop the breath at the end of the inhalation. And there are many, many versions of this. They involve holding the breath in precise ways and actually measuring the duration of the inhalation, the exhalation, and the hold. So classically, you count the way how long the inhalation is, how long the exhalation is, and how long the pause is. And this can be done by actually counting, which is how we often do it. Classically, it's done with mantra. So for instance, if you're practicing with the mantra Hamsa and you were inhaling to a count of four, which we'll be doing in a few minutes, you would say the mantra Hamsa twice. Hamsa, Hamsa, making four. If you're holding for eight, you would say the mantra Hamsa four times, etc. So, and this is considered to be the best way of measuring the breath, because in Sanskrit, every syllable is pronounced in the same way and for the same length of time. Whereas if you count the breath, the numbers take a different amount of time to be thought or articulated. And the main thing about pranayama practice is that the breath needs to become smooth. It needs to lose its jerkiness. It needs to relax. And this is often the thing that we find most challenging because of the way our breathing patterns have tended to be. So again, the function of the pause is not to inhibit the breath, but rather to open the door that leads from the physical, the gross prana, which is the prana of our breathing, to the subtle prana, which is the source of the breath and which underlies the breath, and also to take the movement of inhalation and exhalation from the two channels on either side of the nostrils, the solar channel and the lunar channel, the Ida and Pingala, and allow the breath to flow into the central channel known as the Sushumna. So pranayama, the real goal of pranayama is to activate the Sushumna nadi, the central channel, where the breath doesn't have to be consciously paused. It actually pauses on its own, because when the breath goes into the central channel, and this sounds like complete pie in the sky until you experience it, but when the breath goes into the central channel, you don't need oxygen to breathe. Life is sustained by the pranashakti herself. Sutra 52 and 53 say, this is a poetic translation, as the rising sun slowly disperses the darkness of night, pranayama removes the impurities and refines the practitioner and prepares his body and mind to become fit for concentration and meditation. In Sutra 52, it actually says that pranayama practice removes the coverings over our own light. So find your posture once again. And just spend a moment or two doing a very natural inhalation and exhalation using the abdominal muscles. using an actual diaphragmatic breath. So you're feeling the diaphragm moving downward with the inhalation, just slightly, don't exaggerate. And with the exhalation, feel it gently moving towards the spine. And we're going to do now a very simple counted breath using an equal 4-count ratio with the inhalation, the exhalation, and the hold. And I'm choosing this because it's easier for everybody. But if you, as you mature in this practice, there are several different ratios you could use, and I'll send you a few choices of ratios for the homework. We'll start by inhaling for 2 silent repetitions of Hamsa, which corresponds to a count of 4. We'll hold the breath for 2 repetitions of Hamsa, and then we'll exhale for 2 repetitions of Hamsa and hold for 2 repetitions of Hamsa. So as you inhale, feel that the breath is being drawn in down to the heart. As you exhale, feel that it's being drawn upward towards the crown. So we'll do 3 rounds of this. And as you follow my voice, I'll say inhale, Hamsa, hold breath, Hamsa, exhale, Hamsa, hold breath, Hamsa. So you can follow the rhythm, and then I'll be quiet, and you can do the practice on your own. So for now, take a couple of natural breaths. Again, make sure that the posture is steady and comfortable and lifted. So inhaling, remember the breath flows down to the heart, through the nostrils into the heart. You hold it in the heart. And then with the exhalation, it flows up to the crown. You hold it in the crown. Inhale, Hamsa. Hold, Hamsa. Exhale, Hamsa. Hold, Hamsa. Inhale, Hamsa. Hold, Hamsa. Inhale, Hamsa. Hold, Hamsa. And we'll pause for a moment. You can take a couple of natural breaths. And beginning again, inhale, Hamsa, Hamsa, down into the heart. Hold in the heart for 2 repetitions of Hamsa. Exhale up into the center of the head. 2 repetitions of Hamsa. Hold with awareness in the head, rising to the crown with 2 repetitions of Hamsa. And you can begin. as you are beginning this kind of practice, it's probably a good idea not to do it for longer than 5 minutes, and to remember that if it becomes uncomfortable, if you lose breath, to stop for a minute, take a couple of natural breaths, and then come back to it. What starts to happen after a while is that over time, the space of the suspension starts to become easy and natural and begins to feel light. And it's that expansion of the inner space that starts to dissolve the coverings over the chakras. But it's really important that it not be forced, taking it with gentle attention as far as it feels comfortable. And as you continue the practice, and as many of you know, it begins to become skillful to let the exhalation be longer than the inhalation. So we'll send you a ratio that you can play with. In which we meditate with different lengths of breath, but with a ratio that allows the exhalation to be slightly longer than the inhalation. And this practice that we've just done, the four equal, it's called Samavritti Pranayama, where the inhalation and exhalation and holds are equal, they're even. The other kind is called Samavritti, or unequal lengths of meditation. So we're going to do a longer practice now. But first I want to talk about pratyahara. Because this pranayama practice actually includes pratyahara. As we were saying, asana really cannot be done without pranayama. Pranayama really cannot be done without asana. Pranayama naturally involves pratyahara, which means withdrawal of the senses. And pratyahara and pranayama and asana naturally lead into the subtler forms of inner practice, concentration, meditation, and samadhi. Actually, the traditional commentators on the Yoga Sutras say that the difference between pranayama, pratyahara, and dhyana, or dharana, is just the amount of time you're able to stay present with the focal point. So the minimum amount of time, interesting esoteric fact, that it takes for the mind and breath to come together is 48 seconds, which is about the amount of time it takes to take 12 breaths. So it's pranayama if you're doing this practice for 12 breaths. If you can focus on one of these points, say the heart or the sahasrara or simply the flow of the breath for 140 breaths or about 9 minutes, you're in the range of pratyahara. Dharana or concentration simply means that you're able to stay fully focused for 12 to 15 minutes. And as dharana matures, the natural meditation current begins to draw the mind inward into the state of meditation. And I know that these periods of time sound short. If you've done them, you know that it's actually rather challenging to stay fully focused with the mind in the breath for 12 breaths, and even more challenging to stay focused for 140 breaths. But again, with practice, it happens naturally because yoga is a natural process. So the word pratyahara means to not consume or to not eat. And what that means is that when we do pratyahara, we draw the mind inward so that it's not eating the experiences that are coming to it through the senses. Because normally what happens, as you know, is that the manas, the focusing part of the mind, grasps whatever the senses contact, identifies it, gives it a name, registers it as pleasant or unpleasant, and either lets it in or pushes it away. And this is how we remain outgoing. So in pratyahara, the idea is to let the mind naturally draw back inside And so even though the senses may be registering information, you may be hearing sounds, but in Pratyahara, the mind is able to let it be, to let the sound be, to not grasp it, not to push it away. So in time, rather than naming or analyzing the sound you hear or the object you see, including inner objects, you experience them as energies, as pulsation, and they just become part of your meditation. And again, I know that many of you have this experience. It's just the point where, you know, the sounds around you may seem like white noise, or they don't even register. And that's also true of bodily sensations, sensations that might feel quite uncomfortable. Once the pratyahara really starts to happen, you stop feeling them. And that means the mind leads the senses inward, and the inner senses begin to come online, and they can become a resting place for the mind. So, you know, for instance, when you follow the breath, as we've been doing, the inner sense of touch gets activated, and the mind can take rest in the space, you know, the space that arises through the breath. Or when you let the mantra join with the breath, then the subtle sound, the primordial sound of the mantra, becomes the resting place. When you have a subtle visual experience of luminosity in the Ajna chakra or the heart, the sense of sight means that the sense of sight has followed the mind, and the inner sight is coming online. And at a certain point, when your pratyahara has really matured, your eyes can be open and you can be looking around at the world, but your attention is inside. You know, so there's actually no sense of distinction between the inside and the outside. Before we do our longer pranayama pratyahara practice, I'd like to ask you to start with what I consider to be the ultimate tantric pranayama. tantric pratyahara. And this is a real tantric pratyahara. This is what the tantric texts say. So it comes from the Vijnana Bhairava. With your eyes open or closed, have the thought, whatever I see, hear, taste, or smell is Shakti. Wherever my mind goes, there's nothing but Shakti. When there's only Shakti, where can my mind go to avoid it? So just notice what happens in your mind when you hold this awareness. And I mean, even as you listen to my voice, if you have the feeling the sound of her voice is Shakti, do you notice that there's a kind of a loosening of attention? There's a kind of a loss of grasping or annoyance. It kind of evens everything out. It's like nothing, no one thing becomes more important or interesting than anything else, because it's all equally interesting. We're going to go more deeply into the practice that we were doing earlier, the pranayama with the space in front of the face, and just let ourselves sink into it. And we will meditate for a longer time, for about 5 minutes. So find your posture. And begin by exhaling, seeing if you can follow the exhalation to the point where it dissolves in space. Don't strain to do this. Just see if you can get a sense of this place, this moment where the breath, the exhalation kind of dissolves into the air. And now inhale with the feeling that the air is touching the place just a quarter of an inch in front of the tip of your nostrils. And let the inhalation continue upward past the space corresponding to the corners of the eyes, the space corresponding to the space between the eyebrows, through the space of the center of the forehead. And then exhale with the feeling that the breath flows down that same pathway, flows past the tip of the nose, and dissolves 10 to 12 inches outside your body into the air. The breath now should be smooth, with no space between the inhalation and the exhalation. So it's one continuous motion, inhaling to this space just outside the tips of the nostrils, letting the inhalation rise upward, then flowing seamlessly downward. Beginning to feel that the space outside the physical body and the space within the physical body are really not separate. To recognize that this breath is taking place in the pranic body, inside the subtle body, which is your body, even more than the physical. Meditate on the breath rising and falling in this space just in front of the face. As the breath flows in this ascending and descending pattern, see if you can notice the particular energetic feelings of these different subtle spaces. There's a particular energetic feeling that you become aware of as the breath moves past the eyes, as it flows through the space between the eyebrows and the space of the forehead. Become aware that what is happening through this breath is that the Ajna Chakra, which is the primary chakra for transforming the quality of mind and awareness, the Ajna Chakra is opening. This is what we're cultivating here. And recognize that this space, the Ajna Chakra, is actually being opened from the nasal passages up through the crown, and even as you follow the path of the breath, be aware that the center is within the head, in front of the head, behind the head, above the head. Just let yourself be aware of the natural expansion as the Ajna Chakra begins to open. We offer our practice, asking that it be of benefit to all beings and to the earth. We're going to have an opportunity to cultivate this particular practice and hopefully to experience its power, the power it has to more and more deeply open our sense of the inner body, the subtle body with its currents of prana, the mental body and the body of awareness, which are along with the pranic body contained inside the subtle body, and which really hold the blueprint for our lives. And to recognize how in these practices, the obscurations, the coverings, the veils that keep the fullness of the inner body from revealing its beauty to us are being dissolved, are being lifted. You know, we began book two with the sutras on Kriya Yoga, which said that these practices are done to remove the kleshas and to bring us to the state of samadhi. And that is actually what they're doing. And yet, progress in yoga is not measured by achieving certain benchmarks. It's really measured by the subtle growth of our wisdom, by our increased ability to tune into the intuitive knowledge that lives in the core of the heart and to actually begin to trust it and live by it. It's measured by our ability to let things go, which I've noticed over the course of this time together has become deeper and deeper for so many of you. You know, letting go of our obstructive emotions, letting go of our grievances, letting go of our need to have things come out in a certain way, all those things, and as we let go, we begin to experience the immeasurable quality of the love that remains when everything else is in turmoil. The love that is a genuine recognition that one awareness exists in every living being, and the tenderness and acceptance that we feel towards ourselves and the others in our lives every time that we get that recognition. So each of these techniques transforms us in a particular way. You know, each of them help capture the mind and turn it inside. But of course, what really transforms us is the inner presence, the shakti, the prana that these techniques draw forth. Every glimpse of that presence, every moment of turning to it, dissolves the veils that hide it from us, that hide us from ourselves. And with every veil that dissolves, even the tiniest, our ability to recognize and rest in presence becomes firmer and more available. And this is yoga, resting in the ineffable, indescribable presence, the felt sense of being that becomes available, more available as the mind becomes more quiet, but which is also present when the mind is agitated and restless. With that recognition that we are that presence, that we exist in that presence, let's again become present to all of us here, sitting at the lake together, and to bring our hands together and bow to the center of the circle. Bow to the lake of consciousness itself. Bow to the flames in our hearts. Bow to each other. Bow to grace. May suffering be healed. May truth be realized. May we live in love. Thank you all so much for being who you are, for bringing yourselves into this gathering. and for the tremendous power of grace that your presence brings to me, as well as to each of us. So thank you so much. Our Q&A is on Monday at 5 p.m., and it's going to be on Zoom so we can see each other's faces. Deb will send you a link and more information, and we'll see you there. Thank you so much. So much love to each one of you. Namaste.
मनोबुद्ध्यहंकारचेतानि नाहि न च श्रोत्रजिह्वे न च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमि न तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातु न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव
Shivoham, Shivoham, Shivoham.